Welcome to the Art and Science of Difficult Conversations. I'm Chris.
And I'm Lucy, and we love having difficult conversations.
That's right. And each week, we'll either share a tip, hear how others have gotten better at difficult conversations, or demonstrate common difficult conversations and what to do and what not to do.
Let's get into it.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by a special guest, Andrea. And I'm not going to do much because I want you to share with everybody kind of your story and how you got here.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. I'm so excited to be on your podcast. As you said, my name's Andrea. My last name's Horton Marichli. So it's hyphenated. I'm married to a Turkish immigrant, now a U.S. citizen. Yay.
Nice.
But growing up, I was raised in a multiracial household. My mother's a Mexican immigrant from born in Veracruz, Veracruz. And my dad is a U.S. born American white Anglo-Saxon male. And so I moved around a lot and got to get exposed to a lot of different types of communities and cultures. And that was very eye-opening to me as a young child. And it allowed me to just welcome everybody and be open to meeting new people, different types of people that may not look like me. When my dad retired from the military, we moved back to Texas. My parents got divorced, and my mother raised us three kids in a low-income neighborhood. Sometimes I wonder how she did it. She never went on welfare or anything like that, but the household made like $11,000 a year. Mm. It was I don't know how she did it, but I don't want it. I'm just gonna no. She's just amazing. She budgets extremely well, which I find a lot of immigrants are very good with their finances. But she came over as a child, and in a time where, you know, she was thrown into a native English speaking class. There weren't ESL classes back then, and so she was in that mentality of, you know, my native language is bad. I only should speak English, because every time she spoke her language, she would get punished in class. So we grew up not knowing Spanish, and I didn't realize my mother spoke Spanish until we moved to Texas when my dad retired. And as I said, we moved into a low income neighborhood and in El Paso, Texas. Shout out to El Paso. I realized I felt like I didn't fit in, because even though I had friends and everything, I didn't speak Spanish, so I wasn't Hispanic enough, and I didn't look fully white, so I wasn't white enough. And so I felt a little, I was trying to find my identity. And I didn't feel like I, as I said, fit in anywhere. But as I grew up and got older, I know there's a lot of challenges when I went to university, coming from a low-income neighborhood where I excelled, thought I was doing extremely well. But when I got to university, I realized that there was differences in the public education system based on neighborhoods and districts and everything. And I struggled and ended up, you know, I was also a working college student as well. So I was traditional, but not traditional, because I went right after high school, but I had to work because my parents couldn't afford to help with the tuition and all. And I didn't want to take all the loans. So, but yeah, I struggled and changed majors a couple times because I felt I was trying, as I said, I didn't know where I wanted to go. I didn't know what resources were available to me. And it was just an eye-opening and frustrating experience, making me feel like, am I stupid? Am I not good enough? That's when I really started self-doubting myself. And I ended up moving back home and finishing at the University of Texas at El Paso, which I should have started at to begin with, because it was a smaller school, smaller university in the same University of Texas system, but it was what I needed. It was, as I said, it was a smaller school. Class sizes were smaller. You weren't a number, whereas at the university I started at, you were a number, you know, where there was classes of 300 to 500 plus, and
Yeah.
those weed out classes, it was just so wonderful transferring to a smaller university where you got to know the professors. They knew your name. They were there for support and all. Not that at larger universities they aren't, but it was easier for me to find the resources I need at this at the smaller university. And finished there. Went into found myself after starting at grad school a little bit, falling into the nonprofit realm, and working with individuals with mental and physical disabilities. Helping them find employment, being their work on-site work supervisor, training them, sort of like their job coach as well. And I just really loved it. And then I transferred to Goodwill Industries of Central Texas, now Goodwill Central Texas, and did a similar stuff, and just really loved it. And then I fell into special ed teaching, special education teaching, and became a dyslexia interventionist, and really loved working with my kids. But I also found, because I just chose to work in low-income schools, the type of schools I came from, that's when it was even more eye-opening to me, the differences and the mentality of some of the staff members. I hate to say that, but there was a mentality that not even the special ed kids, the regular ed kids, oh, they're not gonna make anything of themselves, they're gonna fall back into this cycle. And so it was very disappointing to me, and it made me challenge my kids in my class, my special ed classes, even more. Then they were resource classes, not the life skills classes, where there's more severe disabilities. These the students I taught had more learning and emotional and behavioral types of disabilities, challenges I should say, and so I really pushed them and to be their best, and they started excelling, jumping, leaps in reading and writing, and they more than one child, one of my students said to me, "Why do you care so much?" Because they as kids, they absorb everything. They're very observant and they know how people think of them. And so if you're told something over and over and over again, many people, not all people, but many people, you're like, well, why should I even try? They fall into that thing, like, this is what they think of me, so this is what I'm going to be. And that's what they start believing on themselves. It's like, oh, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough. This is all I can do. And so I wanted to break that. And so that's what I started doing with my kids. And then I moved to Turkey after that and taught English as a foreign language and did the same things there. Even though I taught at private schools there, there was a lot of students on scholarship. So I worked with them and helped them. But and then I moved back to the States and fell into workforce development again, helping individuals low income. And then when I moved to Pittsburgh, I fell into the Literacy Council, and I was the first service coordinator on an immigrant services grant that helped immigrant and refugee households get connected to services that to help them become more sustainable and all. And then I was also the career counselor for all the students, not just our immigrant and refugee students, but English-born students as well, who many of which fell through the cracks in the K-12 system for many of the reasons I said earlier. And it was a shame because many of them were very resourceful and so smart, but they fell into that mentality of this is all I can do. And of course life keeps happening, and so they do have additional challenges and barriers that get in the way that prolong stuff. But during my time there and my time in workforce development and teaching special education, I got to advocate for the individuals I was working with and supporting. And And as I said earlier, a lot of these positions opened up my eyes to the reality of, how can I put this? The one story that people tend to believe when they hear, when they decide, make up their minds about somebody or a population or different types of communities. And it's sad to say, but a lot of people fall into that one story belief because that's usually what they hear over and over again. And so these positions allowed me to advocate for these individuals I got to work with and educate others. So in my time outside of teaching and in my other positions, I got to educate different community-based organizations and professionals and sometimes service providers too in how to work with, I guess you can say, individuals who don't look like you, who are may not speak the same language as you or are learning your language, have limit, you know, language limitations, and just work with them as humans, you know, starting with the human centeredness. And so I got to teach cultural diversity, cultural awareness, bias trainings, and things like that. And it was just wonderful because a lot of the obstacles, especially at my time with the Literacy Council, that the adult immigrants would come to me with, that they were experiencing from community-based organizations, different organizations around the county, hospitals, things like that, were just mind-boggling to me. Mind-boggling. I mean, even the some of the federal agencies. I mean, we had a few students who their legal names were FNU. That was their first name unknown, because even though they had their passports, some of them, or they could tell the Homeland Security their names. I guess because of all the speed of processing and stuff like that, they weren't listening appropriately, so they would put FNU, and
Oh,
they
man.
could not change their names until they become a citizen. And
Yeah.
so
Oh.
it's so yeah. So FNU, I was like FNU the first time I saw that. That's a weird name, and it's F dot N dot U, and it's like, oh my gosh. And
Oh,
then the
man.
birthdays as well. January 1st, January 1st, January 1st, January 1st. I'm like, man, so many people born on January 1st. I was like, no, my birthday's April 7th, or no, my I was like, what? You know, it's like, yeah, I told them, but they just put January 1st. And so that human centeredness and is just gone. And actively listening, and also, and I said that that's at the federal level. And even in hospitals, like the processes we would have to do to get more of our Uzbek clients and our Spanish speaking clients to fix the baby certificate, the names on their baby certificates. Baby girl. That would be the first name. Baby girl, and then the last name is like baby boy. I'm like, or they would misspell the names, totally misspell the names. And it's a long process to get things like that changed. And it's, but things like this just increase my passion and desire to want to get into the DEI industry. I know that's a very long-winded answer
No,
to
that's
that one
great.
question, but yeah, so I decided, you know, something is starting my own DEI consulting business was something I've been wanting to do for quite a few years, and last year I finally took the leap. And so I've been you know, working on this ever since, and
Yeah.
it's
Fighting the good
I've
fight.
just been so joyous. Yes. And working with great people and networking with great people like you, Chris. And
Yeah.
yeah, it's just you know, trying to spread the word of love. So
That last story reminds me of in school, I feel like I remember learning about Ellis Island when they were processing immigrants. And they would just shorten last names or change names just because they couldn't understand. They didn't want to bother trying to figure out how to spell it. So it seems like it's just been happening forever.
And it's sad because it's like people, because it also makes people not really know where they came from as generations pass. And because Yeah, because your name is your identity. That's a big part of your identity. And to have it taken away from you like that, and you're not able to do anything about it. I don't know if back then, when Ellis Island was around, if there was processes to eventually change their name again, like there are today, but
Yeah, I don't know.
it's, yeah.
It's unfortunate. Yeah,
It
and I
is,
agree.
it
Your
is.
name is so important. This connects you with your family and your heritage. You said something also earlier in your experience that really resonated with me because about kind of you didn't grow up speaking Spanish, and so you felt in between kind of two worlds. Those are my words, not yours necessarily.
No,
And it
it's
resonates with
true though, I
me.
did.
Yeah, it resonates with me because I'm a child of immigrants, and for everybody that doesn't know, I'm Chinese. So I grew up here, but I grew up in a mostly white area. So to everybody else, clearly I was not white, so I wasn't necessarily part of that group. But also, there's a I'm an American-born Chinese ABC, so I'm always seen as not fully Chinese because I was born here and I don't know the language as well. So it's weird being stuck between two worlds.
It
How did
is.
you kind of navigate that? How did you kind of reconcile that being in between multiple worlds?
It took me a while, I'm not gonna lie. Probably into college, or maybe a little afterwards. I would say probably into college. Because even though as I said, I had friends and of all races, of all colors, of all religions, growing up, so I knew I belonged in that sense, but I didn't know what my identity was. And I mean, I knew I was Andrea Horton, and I knew who my mother was, my siblings, my father, my family, and but in college, I finally, as I got exposed to even more cultures and people from different parts of the, mainly the United States, but also the world, I realized it doesn't matter, what other people think of you, as long as you are happy with who you are. And you bring your true self to the table, and you don't change to fit anybody's idea of what they think you should be, and or what they want you to be. And if they're gonna, and as I said, it took me a while, and it's an, I wouldn't say it's an everyday struggle, but it's something I need to remind myself. I need to be true to myself, because that's gonna make me happy. And I think being in ROTC helped me with that a lot. So I was in Air Force ROTC at university, and loved it. And but it made me realize, they treated they yelled at everybody. Everybody had to exercise, everybody had to show up, everybody had to do their duty. And they didn't care who you were, how tall you were, how short you were, how what color you were. They didn't care. You were the same. And I think that really helped me, and it also allowed me to gain friendships as well, but it's even more friendships. And it gave me some, it helped me build my confidence, because growing up I did have low self-esteem, and it's something many people struggle with, self-confidence. And even today, many people, if not all people, self-doubt themselves. Am I good enough? Are people gonna show up? Are they gonna think I'm smart enough? And I mean, even very successful people think that. And it's something that you just have to kind of push to the back of your brain and just continue showing up and do what you do, and be your authentic self. And but it did take me quite a few years to feel comfortable doing that, because I wanted people to like me. I still want people to like me, but I wanted people to like me, but I want them to like me for who I am. And not everybody is going to,
Well, I like you for who you are, Andrea.
Thank you. I like you too.
You know, I don't want to skip over that because I think that's important, because you're right. A lot of people take forever or a long time to get that confidence in their authentic self. It didn't take it, you know, for me, it took until grad school and a little bit beyond grad school to get comfortable with that. So I'd love to hear your process. How did you get more confidence in who you are and your identity?
I want to say it was probably when I transferred universities back to my hometown of El Paso. Because at the larger university, I'll just say UT Austin, which is a fabulous university, I struggled. Even though I was enjoying my time there, I was struggling. I didn't know where to go. I felt not good enough, not smart enough. And I knew I wasn't, but I was starting to, since I was struggling so much, it was starting to creep in more. And it was like, you know what? I just need to go back home, because I was also working a lot and I was exhausted. And it was just trying to balance that as a kid, because I started university at 17. So it's trying to balance that as a kid, being off on your own for the first time. And you know, you're in that mentality where you're comparing yourself to everybody, and it wasn't healthy, and it was taking its toll on not just on my mentality, but on my grades, on my I wouldn't say mental health, but yeah, pretty much mental health, because I was not feeling good about myself. So I moved back home, sucked it up, moved back home, because nobody wants to go to their home university, which is why we ended up leaving. But I ended up loving it, as I said earlier. And I found myself, because I realized, that's when I realized, not everybody learns the same way. Not everybody, we're all different, and we need to find what works best with us. And as my grades started improving, and I was still working, but living at home really helped, because I knew I had a place to stay, and it just took a little bit of the weight off my shoulders. And as my I started my grades started improving, and I mean, I wasn't a 4.0, but I had some, I all the grades that transferred over, it were kind of low. So I had some a lot of work to do. And I ended up graduating cum laude, and I got into my graduate program the first time into physical therapy. And it was just, it kept building all that confidence. And I realized, I am good enough if I try, if I show up, if I ask for help. And that's what I needed. Like, being at a larger university like UT Austin, I felt like I was drowning, because there was so many people, even though as I said, I loved the experience, I loved everybody I met, but I felt like in my classes I was drowning. And I was, my voice wasn't being heard. I was just a number. And since I didn't know all the processes, I didn't know that you could go to the TA, or you could go. I mean, I didn't know this as a first generation student, and a lot of different things. But at university, when I transferred, I got to talk to the professor directly, and they would give me tips and explain things if I needed further explaining. And it was just very healing in a way, because it's to my self-confidence and self-esteem, because as I started improving and gaining the confidence, it's like, oh, this is easy, I can do this, and I got this. And I started helping others too in my classes, and helping explain processes and different things. And that, when you are a tutor, whether it's an official tutor or unofficial tutor, that boosts your self-esteem. And you know, teaching others and help being a resource for others. So that really helped with improving my self-confidence and self-esteem and all, and knowing who I am and how I learn, and it was, that was my main thing, like not feeling stupid anymore, and knowing that I wasn't, but not being able to not feel that way, and realizing that everybody's different, everybody learns a different way, everybody, and there's all these different resources for everybody who learns different ways. And it got so bad at UT Austin. I had severe test anxiety, and I should have realized that at high school when I got a nosebleed in my SATs and I was out for it was in the verbal section. I don't know if you know, the analogies way back when. I was in there for probably like 20 plus minutes, and that was the sec, because that was the section I was really worried about. And and in university, at UT Austin, I would go blank during finals. Processes that I learned and I knew the night before, I couldn't remember 1 + 1, you know. No. And it started affecting my stomach, and so I would run around. I mean, in a building, I remember it was calculus. It was in a building that I had classes in. I knew that building, and I had to run out of the final, in the middle of the final, because I needed the restroom. It was that bad, and I could not. I was running everywhere. I could not find the restroom, and I was like, "Where am I? Where am I?" I mean, I was just, that is like really bad test anxiety.
Sure.
And it made me feel even. At that time, inadequate, and it did take its toll on my self-esteem at that time, and my, of course, my grades and everything. But yeah, moving and realizing what I needed really helped, and not realizing at the time when I was doing it, but after the fact, it really helped.
Right.
With,
you know, it's so powerful. Your story is so powerful, because I don't know if you're thinking about it as you're talking, but I see so many parallels to even just the conversation we had on your podcast around creating an inclusive environment and psychological safety in a workplace, because it seems like it's very similar themes of creating a safe space where people don't feel like a pressure to perform or put on a facade. A place where people can get those wins and feel successful and get feedback and feel competent in the work that they're doing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and it is very important for organizations to know that every employee is different. There isn't one mold. Every employee needs, I wouldn't say a different onboard, might need a different onboarding style when it comes to learning the task specifics of their job, not outside of like the educational skills and stuff that they should know when they come in, but organizational specific stuff. So that's why mentorship is so important in organizations, EAPs, having those employee assistance programs that encompass financial assistance, financial literacy, therapy, and so many different things. I mean, you can put so many different resources in an EAP department that are accessible to your employees, your teams, because they may need it at one point in their life cycle in your organization. They may need those resources, and them knowing that it's there helps to alleviate some of the stress on them as well. But it's just important for organizations and leaders and supervisors, managers, to know that your team members are all different. They're all going to need different approaches to your leadership style and training and all in it. So that's why it's good to be a servant leader, an inclusive leader. Get to know, not on a personal level really, but get to know your team members. Walkthroughs, like, but not official walkthroughs, but just, you know, say hello, good morning to your team members. Ask it, how's your partner doing? Or, oh, that's such a beautiful picture. Is that your daughter or your son or your brother, your dog? Get to know them a little bit on a personal level, because it'll let them know that you see them, and you value them as a person, not just a team member, but as a person. And they'll start feeling a sense of belonging, and you're laying that foundation for trust. So if they ever do need help with something, they will feel more comfortable coming to you or disclosing something in a one-on-one, which leaders and managers should be having, if not weekly, at least bi-weekly, with their every individual team member. So but getting to know them a little bit is going to lay that foundation, and it is going to let you realize what their style of working is. And they may just flat out tell you too, but many employees don't. So you have to get to know your team members a little bit, so you as a leader can and recognize, like, oh, okay, this Amanda, I'll just say, is more visual. So I need to make sure to have graphics and charts and stuff in my presentations or in our team meetings. Or maybe she can, or they, if Amanda goes by they, can put those together so they can contribute to the team meet. So it's like, being an inclusive leader is more about, this is my way, and this is how it's going to be done. It can't be that way, actually. It has to be, we're in this together. Yes, I'm the supervisor, the manager, and like the captain of the ship, but and I'll go down with the ship. I'll take blame for things, because I'm the leader, and that's what a leader should do. They should never blame a team member when things go wrong. Unless, of course, I wouldn't say even blame them, but they're not doing their job. But it's just it's just so important to have that one-on-one time and with your team, each individual team member, so you can realize what their needs are, recognize what their needs are, so they can be able to perform their best, and that trust is laid down, and they can they know that you see them and value them, and they can then feel more comfortable to come to the workplace and be their authentic selves.
Yeah, and I think you're right, spot on, right? That's the essence of creating an inclusive environment. It's not just about, using the right pronouns or, language. Like, that's helpful. Those are all like nice things, but there are means to an end of actually creating a space where people feel welcome, which was so important for you to find your identity and feel comfortable and confidence, right? Andrea, I'd love to hear just one to two takeaways you have for anybody listening on how they can start finding that confidence to be their authentic self.
Well, one is know that you're not in this world alone. Feel comfortable to ask for help. Start with a family member if that's who you feel more comfortable going to, or a friend, but ask for help. You are not in this alone. They may know resources that you can utilize. Sometimes we just need to talk, so you're not in this alone. Ask for help, and seek out those resources, and connect with those resources. And another takeaway would be, know that everybody struggles. Everybody has that imposter syndrome, that self-doubt. It's natural, but you have to keep showing up. If you don't show up, if you don't try your best, even you might fail, but failure is part of the process. So show up. If you fail, assess what you might, what went wrong, and learn from that. But show up. Because when you show up, people are going to see that. People are going to know that you're reliable, that you're trying, that you don't let anything stop you. So show up, keep showing up, even when it's hard, even when you're feeling inadequate. Because when you show up, that's when continuous learning happens. And then also takeaway three is, as I said, continuous learning. Never stop learning. Life is learning, because no one knows everything. CEOs don't know everything. That's why they have people working for them, because they have the answers. They don't know all of the aspects of the business. So nobody knows everything. So life is learning. Seek out professional development resources. There's a lot of free resources on the internet, webinars, Eventbrite, LinkedIn Learning, and other, you know, Coursera even, and Udemy, but even books, you know, literature and articles and stuff from reputable sources. You know, never stop learning, because that's how you're going to continue to grow and do even better. And that's going to help your self-confidence as well, and self-esteem, because you're going to just keep learning new and different stuff. So, and I guess takeaway four is, know that everybody has implicit biases. Not everybody's going to like you for your authentic self.
Yeah.
Never feel like you have to change yourself to fit in, because not everybody's going to like you. And you just have, it's hard, because, you know, as I said, I like everybody to like me, but not everybody does. So just know that, okay, they may not like me. They'll accept, like, if I have to work with them, they might accept that we have to work together, but you don't have to like each other. Just like each other enough to get the job done, because you know that both of you have something to do in it. But but never change yourself, never fit to the mold, never change yourself to the mold, to the societal norms. Be your authentic self, and be happy to be your authentic self, because that's going to help to continue. That's going to help increase your self-esteem and self-confidence as well.
Andrea's just dropping gems here in this podcast. Really appreciate that. Love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
I love it. I'd love to just, how can people follow you? How can people find you? You know, I was on your podcast, so I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit, but how can people follow you and find you and connect with you?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm on LinkedIn at Andrea Horton Mericli. And that's Mericli. And I'm also on my company page, Diversifuse, is on LinkedIn as well. And I also have a Facebook and Instagram and YouTube channel for Diversifuse. On YouTube, it's under Diversifuse DEI Consulting Services, but Diversifuse DIVERS. That's a long name. SIFUSE. So it's a fusion of diversity and fusion. So it's fusing diversity into another entity. So that's the name of my company. I also have a website, diversifuse.com. There is no www. There's none of that. It's just diversifuse.com. And then you can contact me via email at andrea@diversifuse.com. And as Chris said, I also have my podcast, which I started, I guess, it's been about a month and a half or so now. And it's called Get Diversifused. So it's a play on my Diversifuse company, because we're going to get Diversifuse. So we're going to get fuse that diversity into our everyday lives. And you can find that podcast on YouTube. And I also recently started putting it on Spotify.
Andrea, thank you so much for sharing your, being willing to share your story with me and with everyone here.
Thank you
for your thoughts and advice and your takeaways.
Thank you for having me. It was, as I said before, and on Get Diversity, I love talking about this stuff. I could talk about it forever because I'm so passionate about it. And being human-centered is so important.
Yeah, I love that. And so we'll drop all of her links in the description. Andrea, thanks again for being here.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.